When it comes to high-performing charter schools, location may play an outsized role. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening today. And just ahead on the show, are zip codes driving the success of some local charter schools? We'll look at a new report and take your calls on this too. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, going green with your investments. Plus, a look at Forcura, a true First Coast success story. All of that and more just ahead. But first this hour, location, location, location. For some high-performing local charter schools, location may be the secret sauce. So says a new report. Now, charter schools have been hailed for their smaller class sizes and individualized curriculums. But some Duval County school board members are expressing concerns that local charter schools who perform well are drawing from the same pool of high-performing students that would otherwise attend their neighborhood public schools. In other words, it often comes down to zip code. Now, the school year is winding down, of course, but education is at the top of everyone's minds thanks to this and some other news and notes from our school system. Here with more, Emily Block, the Florida Times Union's education reporter. She joins us now in studio with more about the latest data around charter schools that she's uncovered. Emily, good morning.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. Whether you have a child in a charter school, a public school, or not, we want your opinions about this. It's 549-2937. Give us a call, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open as well. Okay, you have a new piece out today in the Times Union looking at high-performing charter schools, four of them in particular, and concerns by some on the Duval County School Board. They believe that these high-performing schools do as well as they do because they can pick and choose their students, in effect, drawing kids from other high-performing public schools, and that the location of these schools plays a role. Can you explain what your analysis showed?
Sure. So when I started digging into this story, it all came out of a school board workshop meeting where they were talking about charter school applications and how a charter school goes about applying to expand their program or building a new school, starting from scratch, or reapplying for a new term. And a point that was raised was, is location classified? Is location part of that determination process? And the answer is it is not. Members of the school board, like Warren Jones, who's the vice chairman, think that's an issue. And the reason of that is because where a charter school is might determine how it's drawing its students. So Warren Jones is telling people, or Warren Jones expressed at that meeting that a school board or a charter school that is, a charter school that's high performing, meaning that it has, I'm getting over it.
That's okay. Keep going. You're fine. Take a sip of water and just keep on going. And it's 549-2937. Give us a call. Okay. And so Warren Jones had a lot to say at this meeting.
Yes, I'm back. So high-performing charter schools are schools that have received an A grade within the last 3 years, two A's and no less than a B. So AAB, AAA. And within Duval County, four schools made that grade. So four schools in Duval County are high performing.
And these are River City Science Academy, Seaside Community Charter, Duval Charter at Flagler, and River City Science Academy Middle High.
Correct. And okay, if you go through the 2018 school grades, all of those schools got A's in the last year. Now, what Warren Jones is bringing up is where are they located? So if you look on a map, the closest public school to those high-performing charter schools are all within 5 miles. And most of them, well, two of them got A's, one of them got a B, one of them got a C. But then I wanted to look into, well, where is the closest A school? So where is the closest comparable school? And I realized that all of those were within 6 miles. So each high-performing charter school has a comparable public school that is, in its own essence, high-performing within 6 miles. And for people like Warren Jones, they're saying that's an issue, and other members of the school board as well, just because they're saying, well, are they actually doing well because they're a charter school and they're doing innovative programming? Or are they doing well because they're drawing from an area that was already high performing?
You mean they're drawing students from the surrounding neighborhood and drawing students from a higher socioeconomic background? Is that what the argument is? That they are picking and choosing students who come from middle to upper middle class neighborhoods? They come from, more often than not, a two-parent household. They are, these charter schools are able to pick and accept students that have that profile. Or is that not the case? Do the schools have representation from across the city?
It could very well be either of those things, because a charter school doesn't have the same zoning that a public school does. So it could, in essence, pick and choose. At the same time, what we're realizing through looking at a map is that the public schools that are getting students just based off of that zone, unless they're a magnet, of course, are getting high grades already.
Okay, and let me ask you as a follow-up, as all this is going on, as parents are kind of getting ready for the summer break and then thinking about where their children are going to go in the fall for school, recently, Duval Superintendent Diana Green got into a tussle with the Education Commissioner, Richard Corcoran, who runs the State Board of Education, where he criticized Green for the performance of some low-performing schools in Duval and even suggested a state takeover. Superintendent Green has put a proposed half-cent sales tax measure before the Jacksonville City Council, arguing that the traditional public schools infrastructure is falling apart and that more than $1 billion is needed to shore up these aging school buildings. And so as charters proliferate in the state and take state money, superintendents like Green are in the position of having to go hat in hand to local and state officials and beg for money to shore up the traditional public school buildings, not the programs, but the actual buildings.
Right. Well, that stood out to me because at that meeting where Superintendent Green was defending the turnaround programs, I was already working on the story, and she talked about charter schools. She talked about how the charter schools that are doing well are surrounded by public schools that are also doing well. And the charter schools that are doing not so well are surrounded by public schools that are doing not so well. So I looked into the low performing schools. And if you looked at the lowest performing charter schools in Duval County, Duval Charter at Westside, Global Outreach Charter Academy, School of Success Academy, and Somerset Academy Middle and Waverly Academy, which have C's and D's, they have neighbors of public schools that are doing the same, that also have D's and C's, all within 2 miles or less. So it really brings the question of, is this a charter versus public school battle, or would it be more of the same?
We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Of course, it's been 20 years of education reform in Florida, kicking off with the election of Jeb Bush as governor in 1998, you know, instituting the A-plus plan for schools, giving schools a grade, opening up the door to more privatization of schools. And so, you know, after 20 years of school reform, when you look at the progress and the numbers, I think it's fair to say that there have been some successes on the part of some charter schools. That said, it's a mixed record overall. The state of education officials have changed standards multiple times. Teacher shortages remain a huge problem. Florida has not improved its educational outcomes nearly to the degree that was projected when these reforms were undertaken. And so while many parents will say, I prefer having a choice of where I want to send my child, and that's certainly understandable. When you look at the issue in the macro, it's a mixed record at best.
Yeah.
And so what about that?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the statistics based on this research, out of Duval County's 27 charter schools, 10 of them, or 37% were named A schools, which is less than half. And then for larger context, out of Duval County's 31 public schools, 27%, also less than half, were deemed A schools. So it's really only a 10% difference if you're looking at the numbers, if you're just looking at the grades.
Let's go to some calls now as we talk about charter schools and education with the TU's Emily Block. It's almost summer break, but we can get this in right under the wire before we shift our focus to a few other topics in the summer months. 549-2937. Wendy is along Racetrack and US 1. Hi, Wendy. Good morning.
Good morning. My child goes to Flagler Charter School, and we drive past a Duval County A school every morning to put my child into Duval Flagler, Charter School. And several people from our neighborhood do the same thing. My reason for change was primarily discipline, lack of discipline in the Duval County School. The discipline in our class was so bad, they weren't getting anything done. Children were allowed to stand on desks and throw things, and they spent half the day trying to correct papers. Nobody listened to the teacher. And, I'm looking after the education of my child. So at charter school, they have strict disciplinary lines. If you get a referral three times, you're out of the class. So we just made a decision that was best for my child.
Sure. And Wendy, what's the school, what's the public school that you drive by to go to the charter?
Bartram Springs Elementary.
Bartram Springs. Okay. That's Wendy calling from Racetrack and US 1. Thank you for that, Wendy.
Thank you, Wendy. And
she's sending her child to one of the four A-rated charters.
Correct.
That you identified.
Yes.
In your study.
Yes, absolutely. So she's sending her child to Duval Charter at Flagler, which is about 5 miles away from Bartram Springs. And I spoke to the principal at Duval Charter, and she actually said that this was Principal Christina Hamlin. So Christina Hamlin said that it doesn't have to do with location in her mind, but it has to do with the expectations. So she said that at her school, it's a school of distinction, much like our caller Wendy was saying, that it's a parent's choice. And that the schools should really be working together. One thing that she said that stood out to me was that it shouldn't be an us versus them mentality, that it's really a discussion about what's best for the families.
You also interviewed the current school board chair, Lori Hershey, who told the Times Union, the reality is that charter schools are here and it is forcing traditional public school districts to change the way they offer curriculum in order to attract parents who have more of a choice. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yes. So Chairwoman Lori Hershey says that the competition is a good thing, that it should push for excellence. She said that in her district, which is Mandarin, she has the most charter schools. She has 8 right now with a 9th on the way. And she compared charter schools. This is kind of funny to me. She said it's like an Uber versus Lyft or Netflix versus cable. It's something that's here and we have to deal with. And now it's a question of how we're going to navigate those chapters.
Let's go to Daryl in St. Augustine. Hi, Daryl. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, that's the charter schools using public tax dollars is just simply the redistribution of wealth by the Republicans to the charter schools. It doesn't make any sense if you are taking the best students and putting them over there and you're paying a private company to teach them. That's the first comment. The second comment is I'd be interested in the racial makeup of the failing schools and the charter schools, because I think that there's a pretty obvious disadvantage since Jacksonville forced in the 60s to everybody to be in the same school, both black and white. The, you know, that's when we had the white flight out of Jacksonville to the suburbs. And now your schools have, you know, that primarily serve the blacks neighborhood have been, you know, abandoned for 50 years. And, you know, they're going to have a challenge. And so that's really what's going on. And that's the economics and the racial situation from it. As far as the additional cent tax, it won't be long before Mr. Cochran will be coming for those dollars, too, even though the people of Jacksonville will probably vote to support it. I'm sure he will be coming there for, you know, out to get that money, too. Those are my comments.
That's Daryl in St. Augustine. Okay. The criticism he's leveling at the growth of charters coming from some parents and educators has long been that what's at the heart of the growth of this is both the profit motive on behalf of for-profit companies and also racial bias. That has long been the criticism of this, Emily, what we're seeing happening with education in Florida. At the same time, let me point out that last night, Mayor Curry was tweeting about this on Twitter, saying that those that dismiss charter schools either hate the politics of those that support them, are not informed on this issue, or don't care about kids that are being left behind. And so, you know, supporters of the charter movement say this is about the kids. Critics of the charter movement say, no, this is about racism and the profit motive.
Well, I think it boils down to what school board members' concerns are and why they brought up location in the first place at those meetings. It seems like, to them, an easy way to cherry pick who's going to get an easy incentive to reapply and who's going to get these easy incentives as a charter school when really they're doing well because of who they're drawing from. Something that stood out to me when I did this report was Elizabeth Anderson, who's a school board member. She said that charter schools are supposed to place an emphasis on recruiting low-performing students. And can we really say that that's happening when we're looking at high-performing schools being in neighborhoods with already high-performing students? So who are we attributing their success to?
Lots of tweets coming into the show. Here's one from Larry. Don't use the term pick and choose. That implies charters select one particular student over another. Charter schools must accept every application. And if the number of applicants exceeds the enrollment cap, then the school must hold a random lottery to accept students.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, here's another tweet. There is no consistent evidence that charter schools did any better or worse than public schools. It depends on geography, as your reporter found based on the data. Here's another tweet. We are within 6 miles of an A school, but we are not zoned for it. A Seaside Mandarin is our only reasonable option. Others have lower grades and behavioral issues. Here's one more tweet. I love parents having choices for their child, but what about their neighbor's child? Those of us without children pay for all children. And let's go to a lot of your calls. By the way, read today's Times Union as you can get more deeply into the data that's reported today. Naeem is on the south side. Hi, Naeem. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. My question is, how much does it cost to the taxpayer sending it to the public school versus charter school? Is it the same amount of money paid to both schools?
Well, not exactly, Naeem. There's not an easy answer to that question. However, Emily, you can elaborate a little bit more.
Yes, of course.
Some taxpayer money does go toward charter schools. Charter schools are officially considered public schools.
Yes. So while I won't go into all the nuts and bolts and item lines, I will say that charter schools are considered public schools. So when money, taxpayer money, is going to a public school lottery of some sort, it is also applying to charter schools as well.
Let's go to Kayima on the west side. Kayima, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Ladies, I'm just thinking, if you're going to pick students, hand-pick students from the AAB scenarios, most of those students are white because they come from the better neighborhoods, they go to the better schools, and yes, they're going to do well when they go to charter schools. I don't know what you're supposed to do, but I do know that if you go to the charter schools and count the white people and count the black children, you will find that there's a disproportionate number. So I just thought that I would mention that.
Thank you.
Because I know a lot of times, Melissa, you don't want to really tackle the black-white issue. You will say something, but you don't tackle it because you're like a bulldog when you want to get something done.
Well, listen, I am not afraid of tackling it. I promise you. And I'm happy to have that discussion, Kaima. You know, I think that it's important in this community to have honest conversations about race, and that we don't do it often enough.
No, we don't.
So let's talk about your comment. Let's talk about your comment. And that's Kayima on the West Side. Okay. And I mentioned this a few minutes ago that like so many other issues in American life, race is part of the contentiousness of this, Emily.
Of course.
Now, we could point to the Kipp School, which is in Health Zone 1 and mm-hmm. does have a majority African-American student population. That said, what about Kayima's comment that many times parents, in choosing a charter school, even though they might not say that this is why they're doing it, that the subtext of it could be that they don't want their kids in a school with a large minority population?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing about this report that starts to dive into it, even though it is obviously a massive, massive topic that would require a lot more demographic digging and a lot more time, obviously.
I know your resources are limited, but I think that would be an interesting report to read.
I agree 100%. But one thing I can say is that school grades, the A's, the B's that we're talking about, and the high performing that comes from that, things that are factored into that are graduation rates and success rates and dropout rates and things like that. So it plays a part in it. But of course, there's so much more that we could expand on and look into.
And we have jammed lines and so many tweets on this. We do have to wrap it up, though, as we are coming up to a break. So thanks to everyone who expressed their opinion about this. And thank you, Emily Block of the Times Union. Read her report today, pick up a paper, or go to jacksonville.com. And yeah, I would love to see that demographic study done. Maybe that's your next report.
Sit tight.
All right. Thanks so much for that.
Much
more still ahead. Sure. Later in the hour, going green with your investments. But up next, Craig Mandeville, a true First Coast success story. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm David McGowan, President and CEO of WJCT. Join me on June 18th for an evening with Frontline's Michael Kirk. We'll discuss his recent documentary on the Supreme Court and his distinguished career as one of this country's leading documentary filmmakers. That's Tuesday evening, June 18th. Visit wjct.org/events for tickets and more information.
That sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out, and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m., only on 89.9 FM, WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, they're a fast-growing local company now reaching $10 million in sales. In today's First Coast Success, Karen Bruni-Mathis of the Jax Daily Record speaks with Craig Mandeville, founder of the high-tech healthcare platform, Forcura.
Craig Mandeville is the CEO of Forcura, a technology platform that connects healthcare organizations. A Texas native, he came to Jacksonville in 1999, and after creating other ventures, he founded Forcura. It has grown to $10 million in sales and more than 50 employees, and he has big plans. Craig Mandeville, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Karen.
Well, briefly, describe Forcura and what Jacksonville needs to know about it.
Forcura, essentially, we're a software platform, and we're a clearinghouse for referrals that are coming out of the hospitals into post-acute care settings, mainly home health and hospice. We normalize those referrals and provide meaningful, insightful data for those providers, and really improving communications with the internal staff and also physicians and payers all across the country.
How did you know this was a good idea when you came up with it?
I started the company in 2012, and there was a conference down in Orlando. It was a post-acute trade show, and I went down, and really all I had was a prototype. And I went down really just to get some feedback to see if what I had had product market fit. And I bought a booth the first day at that show. I had a ton of feedback saying, this is a huge gap. You're solving a big need. This is going to improve my revenue cycle management and ultimately improve patient care. So that evening I went out and printed off some contracts. I really didn't intend to sell the platform at that show. It was really for feedback. And at that trade show, I was able to come back with four signed paying contracts, which at that point, well, we knew we had something, and really we shot off like a rocket from there.
Now, explain a little bit more. How does it work?
Yeah, so the mainly our customers, are really utilizing older tools and processes. Example, a lot of our customers, it takes, 3 to 5 hours to onboard a new patient that's coming from the hospital and into a post-acute care service like home care, hospice, skilled nursing. Our software automates that, and we're able to provide meaningful information. The clinician has the information that they need to ultimately make better and more informed patient care decisions in the home.
So growing to $10 million in sales in that amount of time, you must have some growth projections then for the next few years as well. What are those?
Yeah, so we've got big plans, getting to a $10 million run rate, closing out last year, 2018. We are projected to close out 2019 north of $20 million and run rate. And we're not stopping there. We're transitioning the organization to really more of a AI data analytics platform. We're really the clearinghouse, when you think about it, of referrals that are coming from the hospital to the post-acute care setting, and having meaningful insights and providing better patient care, and even meaningful data to share with the payers and even back to the hospitals is really where we're taking this. We feel we're going to exceed $100 million in revenue in the next 2 years. So the university, specifically Jacksonville University, the University of North Florida, I've noticed a lot of that talent is now staying in Jacksonville. We're integrating heavily into those education facilities to stand up powerful internship programs, keep the talent here in Jacksonville versus going to Atlanta, Charlotte, or Orlando, or Tampa. Over the last decade, I've been seeing a lot more of that happen. So we got to start there. And I also think connecting a lot of the innovators that are here in Jacksonville, technology or not, those that are making a difference and putting Jacksonville more in the limelight, we need to all get together and communicate and work together to, really pull Jacksonville into, really a innovation hub in the Southeast Corridor. That's one of my main goals over the next several years. And it's one thing that we're starting actually in our organization, which is called Innovate Jax. So on June 27th, we're having an event at our office where we're pulling together what we feel are the key, who's to know in Jacksonville innovators, and we're only going to expand it from there. So more to come.
Craig Mandeville, founder and CEO of Jacksonville-based Forcura, thanks for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you so much, Karen, for having me. Really appreciate it.
You can read more about Forcura in the Daily Record, and we'll be right back.
First Coast Success is brought to you by IBERIABANK.
WJCT's new podcast tells the stories of local people.
You have one of your soldiers laying there, and you have the person that is trying to kill your soldiers on the opposite side.
It wasn't so much that I felt guilty. I felt like it was impossible for him to love me.
I wasn't born with a crack pipe in my mouth. Thank you, Jesus. I'm not going to die with one.
What It's Like is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Christina. What's on the front page of today's Times Union?
At the top of the page, Florida lawmakers made...
Around the country, volunteers are reading local newspapers to people with vision loss or print disabilities. Did you know WJCT has this service? On a special radio we provide, you'll get the Florida Times Union every day. Learn more at wjct.org/radio reading. With help from sponsors like Florida Eye Specialists, radio reading gives voice to the printed word.
We didn't think it was a big deal for me to be a pregnant man. In Portland, like maybe if you see a pregnant man at Starbucks, that's not the weirdest thing you've seen that day.
Join us for more true stories told live. This week, a pregnant man, a wedding, a divorce, and something called the Nacho Challenge. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
From the roots of jazz with Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis to contemporary artists like Melody Gardot and Eric Tufas, 89.9 HD4 plays nonstop jazz 24/7 for the month of May.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. Well, it's a huge leap forward for clean energy. The renewable energy sector in the United States, it's projected to generate more energy than coal-fired plants for the first time. This according to a new report published by the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysts. Now, this is the first time this has happened, and it's happened last month in April. Renewables include hydro, biomass, wind, solar, and geothermal. At the same time, a local study looking at the impact of green investing is out. It's called the Green Transition Scorecard, and it's the focus of our Going Green. Hazel Henderson, president of Ethical Markets Media, is on the line now from St. Augustine with more about the scorecard. Hazel, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And you've been doing this Green Transition Scorecard for several years now, showing how the global economy is flowing into green investing opportunities. What do your numbers show?
Well, it's amazing. We started doing the Green Transition Scoreboard in 2009, and our first number was 1.3 trillion, and now the cumulative number that we're putting out today is 10.387 trillion. Now, in invested privately, we're not talking government money here, we're talking private investors, and we have very strict standards. We're talking about renewable energy, solar, wind, we're talking about energy efficiency, green construction, corporate green R&D, and we've been watching very carefully. The financial markets are really scared now that the green transition globally is happening too fast for them to change their financial models. And so we've identified that a real problem now is what we call science denial. And this has actually become a financial risk now, where they really can't change the models that they're using fast enough. And so they've got all kinds of what we call stranded assets on their balance sheets, like fossil reserves that can never be lifted out of the ground without cooking the planet. And so we've been watching this very carefully. And now what we've noticed is there's a new set of these stranded assets, and this is being covered by a financial group in Britain which has $11 trillion in their consortium investing in plant-based protein alternatives to meat diets, to livestock raising. And raising cows and sheep and goats, feeding them, now is causing 15% of all of the greenhouse gases in the world. So what we found is that even meat companies like Tyson, the chicken people, they are now investing in plant-based alternatives to chicken. And they have a new venture capital firm called Tyson Ventures. And they put, for example, $55 million into Beyond Meat. And that's the company that did an IPO about a week ago and had a pop of three times. It was the largest pop of any IPO that anyone had seen for decades. So this is all moving very fast now.
And so what I hear you saying is, whether it's investing in plant protein sources or other green energy sources, in the end, the market decides. And we're seeing a rapid speeding up of global financial markets turning to renewables at the same time as just this week, the renewable energy sector reported it's going to project more energy for the first time this month than traditional fossil fuel sources.
Yes.
So both of those things are happening at the same time.
Right. And we decided to do this green transition scoreboard 10 years ago because we realized that the rate that private investments were going into solar, wind, and all of the renewables, that they would scale fast enough so that the price would keep coming down. And that's what's happened now. And as you know, the price now of solar and wind is the cheapest way to generate energy, whether it's in these distributed networks, you know, where groups of homeowners, we call them microgrids, or whether it's even power plants. It's now cheaper to use solar and wind than it is to use fossil fuels or nuclear.
What would you say, though, to the argument that transitioning to renewables is going to be a bumpy road, that we just aren't in a place yet to set up an energy grid that is completely fossil fuel free and won't be for some years?
Well, that's true, but the electric utilities, the old companies that use the national grids, have been resisting the supplies of solar and wind-generated electricity because they didn't really know how to incorporate them into their structure. And they've realized now that just the way they manage demand of consumers, they now have to manage this new renewable electricity supply, because if they don't, they're going to go out of business. Because what's been happening, as we all know, is that people go off the grid and they put their own solar panels up on the roof. And so the electric utilities are desperately scrambling to figure out what is their new business model. And so this is moving very fast because the electric utilities, too, are being being hammered by the stock markets until they change their old business model. And, of course, the other big thing that's happening to petroleum is the shift to electric cars. And that's happening all over the world, and most of the oil sector realizes this.
That they've got to transition. Let me just jump in, Hazel, and point out that your report is incredibly timely, given that just today it's being reported that JEA is looking at steep double-digit increases in electric and water rates for its customers over the next decade if they keep a status quo approach in the way that they provide energy. This was a dire outlook given to the JE board yesterday, telling them that their water bills will go up 52%. Energy rates up 40% unless they make changes. And they're certain to be painful changes.
Exactly. And I mean, FPL has been trying to adapt for a long time, and they're owned by a big Midwestern company now. And so they are having to move much faster because, see, the more they put up the price, the more people will go off the grid and simply say, okay, enough is enough. You know, I'm going to put my own solar panels up. So they're in a no-win situation. So what we found is very interesting is that they're trying to keep up their market demand for their fossil electricity by going to state legislatures and saying, okay, we'll provide the electric vehicle chargers, and you can dig in the street and you can hook up to our fossil electricity to charge your electric car. But, of course, that defeats the whole purpose of having an electric car in the first place. So, for full disclosure, I've been an investor for a long time, very patient, in a company which has solar-based electric chargers where you don't have to dig in the street. These things roll off the back of a truck. You can put them into a parking space on every petroleum station and every Holiday Inn parking area. And they pay for themselves in no time. And they can charge your electric car with totally solar energy, no digging, no permitting. And at the same time, they can charge your car in 15 minutes. Because they have a battery in there as well. So, you see, this is what the fight is going on now at the state legislatures. It's very interesting to watch.
Including our own. I would encourage everyone to go to Ethical Markets Media to read more about this. It's the annual Green Transition Scoreboard. Hazel Henderson is president of Ethical Markets Media. It's always fascinating to have you on. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you, Melissa. Take care.
And in a moment, a preview of our own Sinking Cities community discussion event at WJCT and how you can be part of it. That's next.
The First Coast Free Thought Society book group will discuss Going Ape by Brandon Haught, which chronicles Florida's battles over evolution, beginning at 11:30 Sunday, June 2nd at a diner on Phillips Highway. Details at firstcoastfreethoughtsociety.org.
Join WJCT the evening of June 4th for a community discussion of the PBS series Sinking Cities and the effects of sea level rise on the First Coast. For more information, visit wjct.org/events.
In the 1980s and 90s, activists fought to fast-track AIDS medicines by confronting the government. Now they're back at it. The new target? Cheaper access to an HIV prevention pill. I'm Ari Shapiro, taking on the high price of HIV medication this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. As Florida prepares to let teachers carry guns in school next fall, we're hearing from those in favor and those against. A Parkland teacher says he doesn't want to be armed in the classroom.
I am a gun owner, but I have not had the training nor the experience. I don't want that responsibility.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Oklahoma is leading the legal fight to make drug companies pay for the opioid epidemic. Johnson & Johnson, the nation's largest drug maker, argues that it has done nothing wrong. Other companies have settled out of court. How should Big Pharma fix the damage from opioid abuse? And for that matter, are we suing the right people? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, next Tuesday night here at WJCT, we will host a community discussion around the landmark PBS series Sinking Cities and the effects of sea level rise on the First Coast, from St. Augustine's historic sites to Jacksonville's riverfront properties. Here is a listen now to the national PBS show.
The world's great cities face threats they have never before encountered.
Very frightening moments unfolding in eastern Japan.
The threats come from the sea.
If you get 6 feet of sea level rise, it would be a catastrophic flood.
From above.
Pounded with heavy rain for 2 days in a row.
And from below.
Nobody anticipated that much water coming in.
These are the problems and their solutions.
So we're looking at floating communities, essentially architecture on water.
For when the water comes.
Floating communities, is that in our future? WJCT News Director Jessica Palumbo is here now as we talk more about sinking cities. Good morning.
Good morning. What I like about sinking cities is that we heard solutions. Solutions is a big part of this program. I watched the Miami program. It's a really, really well-produced show about people who are trying to adapt and make a difference now, because they know what's coming. It's really hitting them hard in Miami already.
It sure is.
And in Jacksonville. So we'll see at this program, we'll get a preview of Miami and maybe a couple of other cities in this series. And then we'll see what's happening here locally.
That's right. We've produced pieces as well that you'll be able to see at this event and on our website, looking at the effect of storms and water rise in St. Augustine, at the beaches, and in downtown Jacksonville. Particularly in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma, and how the city is responding, or in some cases not always responding, to the effects that we saw and that we know we're going to see more of in the future.
And what I like about what you did in these videos, Melissa, is you went out and you found people who are working on ways to make themselves more resilient. You found businesses, you found homeowners, you found elected officials who are saying, okay, we're not just going to lie down and take this. We are going to do something now.
That's right. One of the elected officials we interviewed is Mayor Ellen Glasser of Atlantic Beach, who's been really proactive on this issue, along with all of the beach's mayors. If you come out to our event here at WJCT next Tuesday night, we'll also have an amazing panel of experts on this, including Eric Olson, who's on the Working Group on Flooding in Jacksonville. He's a coastal engineer. Elizabeth Payne, who runs the Northeast Florida Regional Council. Lisa Reinemann, the Riverkeeper. And John Upton of Climate Central, coming down from New York for this event. And this is a free event. Anyone can come on out and join the discussion, which is what we always encourage at our town halls, Jessica.
It's a community discussion. It's not just listening to these experts talk to each other, but the goal is really to engage you. So come on out if you are interested in how sea level rise might affect you if you live in Northeast Florida, how it's affecting you now, what people are doing about it, what people are not doing about it. Ask your questions directly. The event is June 4th. That's a week from today. And it starts at 6:30 with a reception, so you can get to know the people And then we'll start with some screenings of Sinking Cities. Sinking Cities, you'll be able to watch the entire programs coming up on PBS in June.
Yes, definitely watch the full hour of this four-part series, four different hours, when they screen on TV around the country. And then also, we're excited as well here at WJCT to debut a brand new digital offering we've been working very hard on for months, and people will get their first look at it next Tuesday night. It's called Adapt.
And we are going to be giving a preview of Adapt at this event. So this is the preview of the preview.
That's right.
We're not giving away too much right now, but Adapt is coming. We are very excited. As Melissa said, we've been working on it for months. It's a big project for us here at WJCT, and you'll be able to go there and learn more about what's happening in our region.
Definitely come on out next Tuesday night to WJCT for our Sinking Cities event. This is free, but seating's limited, so reserve your seat now. Just go to wjct.org/events, and we'll see you here next Tuesday night. Jessica, thanks so much.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And we always value your feedback. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, how to support your college-bound ADHD student as they transition into this major life change. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8, keep listening for the Electro Lounge. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.